going to go ahead and call our January 21st, 2025 Columbia City Council's pre-council to order. On tonight's agenda, we've got our annual labor group presentations and then a legislative priorities discussion. Because we have some new council members, and let's be honest, veteran council members, when we were talking about our annual labor discussion, before we jump into the presentations, I'd like to ask for some overviews from staff on both what we can and cannot do, and then also the difference, because I feel like we have one that's a contract opening and others that are wage reopeners, and just kind of give us some ground rules so we don't mess this up. So I don't know, DeCarlin, who you want to start with?
And I think
going to start.
I'm not prepared for this yet, but I want to do it.
You don't have food in your mouth.
No, I do not.
By the time she gets up here.
Section 1925, which is employee relations, and then we also have the reserve management rights.
So what Kristen is handing out to you is section 1925 of the city code. It talks about employee relations and how those are handled between the city council, the labor groups, and the city manager's office. In general, as you know, the city council sets policy. It does not engage in negotiations directly. And under section 1925, the council as individuals are actually prohibited from engaging in collective bargaining. Now, the ordinance does set out the right for labor groups to come and talk to the city council and give you their priorities for the year, and that's what this meeting is about. So tonight you're going to hear from the labor groups as to what their priorities are, and then after that we will go into closed session. You'll have a chance to talk with the city manager, who is the person who under the city code is responsible for the collective bargaining with all of the labor groups. So just to walk through some of the other items in sections 19 through 25, and that's what's actually been handed out to you. And I don't know, what's the other section that was handed out?
1926, which is the reserve management.
Okay, the reserve management rights in 1926. So in 1925, the city manager designates representatives of his staff to engage in the collective bargaining process. The city council issues any guidance that it has to the city manager, and then the city code does limit the bargaining groups to presenting to council once per month. Again, that's on their priorities. It's not for you to engage in collective bargaining with them or direct collective bargaining in violation of these particular provisions. It's just to get a better understanding of what their priorities are, and I think that helps city staff as well as a part of that process. Neither the parties are supposed to be talking about matters that are being discussed in collective bargaining during the pendency of those collective bargaining sessions under section 1929 unless the parties have agreed to issue a joint statement as a part of that. And then the city is required to also collectively bargain as to any modifications in Chapter 19 and required to negotiate on those. Usually when we provide, there's a notice provision in the city code for how all those changes to Chapter 29 are handled. Usually those are not things that are affecting a labor group unless it's something that's actually been talked about in advance, or it's something that is ministerial in function or duty. And then you have the list of reserve management rights in front of you. I did not print those off, but if you have, those are the things that are left to your city administrator and then to this city council ultimately to adopt as part of the process. If you have any questions, for me or Kathy as part of the process. I know Kathy's got a timeline that she can walk through with you, the specific timeline as to how that process occurs throughout the year. And then also, the contracts actually provide what are the open items in any particular year. We have one contract this year that is a full contract negotiation, and then all the others are limited to what happens to be open items or what the parties choose to make open items as part of the process.
Okay. So part of 1925, which you have in front of you, is the timetable for the collective bargaining process. So prior to today, for FY26, any labor group that wanted to present tonight to council had to submit their goals and objectives by December 15th. We had three groups that submitted and requested to present tonight, and they will go in order in which I received their response. So we have Local 1055, then we have Local 955, and we have CPOA that will be presenting tonight. CPLA did not submit any goals and objectives at this time, and the Water and Light Association did submit goals and objectives, but they did not want to present. So we do have the five labor groups. So tonight is January, where they get an opportunity to present. February 1st is the deadline for groups and management to prepare written proposals for revisions to ordinances or existing collective bargaining agreements. February and March are discussions for non-economic issues with the goal of concluding by March 31st. April through June is when we get into economic issues and any remaining non-economic issues that with the goal of concluding by June 21st. Any group that's dissatisfied with the process of the discussions may present in April to the council at a work session meeting, and by June 1st or before June 1st, city representatives or employee groups dissatisfied with the process may also request the services of a mediator. So these are a guideline. So we're in the very early stages tonight, which is their first opportunity to present their goals and objectives. And Mayor, I believe you asked about what's the difference between full contract versus open items. And Nancy talked a little bit about that. For collective bargaining agreements, the terms open items and full contract refer to the scope and extent of the issues being negotiated between the city and the labor groups. Full contract means it's the full agreement that covers all terms and conditions of employment. The only group that has a full contract this year is Local 1055. I will note that the Water and Light Association does not have a contract, so we could discuss anything with the Water and Light Association because we do not have a contract with them, and that is their choice not to have that. Open items refer to specific issues or provisions within the CBA that the parties acknowledge are unresolved and still under negotiation, and they are outlined specifically in the collective bargaining agreement. The city and the labor groups can mutually agree to open an item that is not specifically listed as an open item, as Nancy alluded to. Mayor, did that cover the topics you wanted to discuss before they present?
I think so. I think one just outstanding thing, just thinking about, I think it was from something that Nancy said during this process right now in this presentation, when we talk about the goals and responsibilities, is this also, I mean, this is the idea is that council is then giving guidance to city management as they enter into that. Is that a correct?
That is correct.
Allowance for what we're allowed to give on our guidance. Okay.
At a policy level.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Questions from council. I saw Betsy and then Nick.
So my question was just there are other open items, even if it's just a wage opener, there are other items that are discussed every year, it seems like. Are those pretty common?
So there are specific open items that will be open for discussion in addition to a wage reopener per the contract. Fire, for example, it will be everything is open because it is a full contract. Mm-hmm. If there is an item that is not specifically listed as open in a contract, both parties can mutually agree to discuss that. Did that answer the question?
Clarification, what if one party doesn't agree?
Has to be mutually agreed to.
That means both.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Nick, you had a question.
On 1925, the schedule there in February and March, about concluding discussions on non-economic issues. Can you talk about what those would be?
So a good example is Local 1055 Fire has a full contract. So that's going to be all terms and conditions of employment. And it could be anything from scheduling, work schedules, leave time. It could be any of those things. We try to focus on the non-economic issues first because we don't know the status of our finances until we get further into the fiscal year. So by design, April is when we start talking about the economic issues.
Other questions for staff? I have an additional one, and I think, DeCarlin, this is more for you or your kind of team. When we're talking about agreement of an option, you know, agreement of opening up an item to be open for discussion, what are some of the parameters that you or your staff would take into consideration about opening that up or not?
It really depends on what the question is. So it can be a financial question, it can be, timing, and so it varies. And so I don't think there's a set emphasis on, agree to this or want to do this, but it really depends on what we're talking.
Give some examples of things that have been opened up that might help.
I have not said anything to negotiations
in a while. Hey, I'm gonna go ahead and call our January 21st, 2025 Columbia City Council's pre-council to order. On tonight's agenda, we've got our annual labor group presentations and then a legislative priorities discussion. Because we have some new council members, and let's be honest, veteran council members, when we were talking about our annual labor discussion, before we jump into the presentations, I'd like to ask for some overviews from staff on both what we can and cannot do, and then also the difference, because I feel like we have one that's a contract opening and others that are wage reopeners, and just kind of give us some ground rules so we don't mess this up. So I don't know, DeCarlin, who you want to start with.
And I think Nancy's going to start.
I'm not prepared for this yet, but I'll have to do it.
You don't have food in your mouth.
No, I do not.
She knows by the time she gets up here.
Yeah.
He's doing that. Kristen's going to hand out the ordinances that guide this process. Section 1925, which is employee relations, and then we also have the reserve management rights.
So what Kristen is handing out to you is Section 1925 of the city code that talks about employee relations and how those are handled. Between the city council, the labor groups, and the city manager's office. In general, as you know, the city council sets policy. It does not engage in negotiations directly. And under Section 1925, the council as individuals are actually prohibited from engaging in collective bargaining. Now, the ordinance does set out the right for labor groups to come and talk to the city council and give you their priorities for the year, and that's what this meeting is about. So tonight you're going to hear from the labor groups as to what their priorities are, and then after that we will go into closed session. You'll have a chance to talk with the city manager, who is the person who under the city code is responsible for the collective bargaining with all of the labor groups. So just to walk through some of the other items in sections 19 through 25, and that's what's actually been handed out to you. And I don't know, what's the other section that was handed out?
1926, which is the reserve management rights.
Okay, the reserve management rights in 1926. So in 1925, the city manager designates representatives of his staff to engage in the collective bargaining process. The city council issues any guidance that it has to the city manager, and then the city code does limit the bargaining groups to presenting to council once per month. Again, that's on their priorities. It's not for you to engage in collective bargaining with them, or direct collective bargaining in violation of these particular provisions. It's just to get a better understanding of what their priorities are. And I think that helps city staff as well as a part of that process. Neither the parties are supposed to be talking about matters that are being discussed in collective bargaining during the pendency of those collective bargaining sessions under section 1929, unless the parties have agreed to issue a joint statement as a part of that. And then the city is required to also collectively bargain as to any modifications in chapter 19 and required to negotiate on those. Usually when we provide, there's a notice provision in the city code for how all those changes to chapter 29 are handled. Usually those are not things that are affecting a labor group unless it's something that's actually been talked about in advance, or it's something that is ministerial in function or duty. And then you have the list of reserve management rights in front of you. I did not print those off, but if you have, those are the things that are left to your city administrator and then to this city council ultimately to adopt as part of the process. If you have any questions for me or Kathy as part of the process, I know Kathy's got a timeline that she can walk through with you, the specific timeline as to how that process occurs throughout the year. And then also the contracts actually provide what are the open items in any particular year. We have one contract this year that is a full contract negotiation, and then all the others are limited to what happens to be open items or what the parties choose to make open items as part of the process.
So part of 1925, which you have in front of you, is the timetable for the collective bargaining process. So prior to today for FY26, any labor group that wanted to present tonight to council had to submit their goals and objectives by December 15th. We had three groups that submitted and requested to present tonight, and they will go in order in which I received their response. So we have Local 1055, then we have Local 955, and we have CPOA that will be presenting tonight. CPLA did not submit any goals and objectives at this time, and the Water and Light Association did submit goals and objectives, but they did not want to present. So we do have the five labor groups. So tonight is January, where they get an opportunity to present. February 1st is the deadline for groups and management to prepare written proposals for revisions to ordinances or existing collective bargaining agreements. February and March are discussions for non-economic issues with the goal of concluding by March 31st. April through June is when we get into economic issues and any remaining non-economic issues that with the goal of concluding by June 21st. Any group that's dissatisfied with the process of the discussions may present in April to the council at a work session meeting, and by June 1st or before June 1st, city representatives or employee groups dissatisfied with the process may also request the services of a mediator. So these are a guideline. So we're in the very early stages tonight, which is their first opportunity to present their goals and objectives. And Mayor, I believe you asked about what's the difference between full contract versus open items. And Nancy talked a little bit about that. For collective bargaining agreements, the terms open items and full contract refer to the scope and extent of the issues being negotiated between the city and the labor groups. Full contract means it's the full agreement that covers all terms and conditions of employment. The only group that has a full contract this year is Local 1055. I will note that the Water and Light Association does not have a contract, so we could discuss anything with the Water and Light Association because we do not have a contract with them, and that is their choice not to have that. Open items refer to specific issues or provisions within the CBA that the parties acknowledge are unresolved and still under negotiation, and they are outlined specifically in the collective bargaining agreement. The city and the labor groups can mutually agree to open an item that is not specifically listed as an open item, as Nancy alluded to. Mayor, did that cover the topics you wanted to discuss before they present?
Yes.
I think so. I think one just outstanding thing, just thinking about, I think it was from something that Nancy said during this process right now in this presentation, when we talk about the goals and responsibilities, is this also, I mean, this is the idea, is that council is then giving guidance to city management as they enter into that. Is that a correct?
That is correct.
Allowance for what we're allowed to give on our guidance. Okay.
At a policy level.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Questions from council? I saw Betsy and then Nick.
So my question was just, there are other open items, even if it's just a wage opener, there are other items that are discussed every year, it seems like. Are those pretty common?
So there are specific open items that will be open for discussion in addition to a wage reopener per the contract. Fire, for example, it will be everything is open because it is a full contract. Mm-hmm. If there is an item that is not specifically listed as open in a contract, both parties can mutually agree to discuss that. Did that answer the question?
Clarification, what if one party doesn't agree?
It has to be mutually agreed to.
That means both.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Nick, you had a question.
On 1925, the schedule there in February and March about concluding discussions on non-economic issues. Can you talk about what those would be?
So a good example is Local 1055 Fire has a full contract. So that's going to be all terms and conditions of employment. And it could be anything from scheduling, work schedules, leave time. It could be any of those things. We try to focus on the non-economic issues first because we don't know the status of our finances until we get further into the fiscal year. So by design, April is when we start talking about the economic issues.
Other questions for staff? I have an additional one, and I think, DeCarlin, this is more for you or your kind of team. When we're talking about agreement of an option, you know, agreement of opening up an item to be open for discussion, what are some of the parameters that you or your staff would take into consideration about opening that up or not?
That really depends on what the question is.
Examples of things that have been opened up that might help?
I have not said anything to negotiations in a while.
I'm trying to think, Zach, we mutually agreed.
The pension was a good one. You guys wanted to discuss that while the contract was in terms. We did not agree to open that as a discussion. So it was delayed until now.
Not opened.
Okay. Well, I'm looking for a different type of example, Zach.
But when it comes to the open items themselves are actually negotiated as part of the collective bargaining agreement. I think that's kind of what Zach's referring to, is that when we get down toward the end of that negotiation period and there are four or five things that are still out there, that the teams have not reached consensus on or agreement on, those are determined at that point in time. We say, okay, we want to leave this as an open item for next term, right? And we actually designate those specifically in the contract, what we're going to talk about once this contract gets entered into. Pensions being one of those, and really talking about those midterm, we have to work as a staff on those midterm, but we don't necessarily have to collectively bargain on those. But other items that might come up would be if there's a,
I thought this was what your Zach, I thought this is where Zach was going to go.
We love the trade times open line.
Well, you were asking when we have mutually agreed to open something.
Yes. Mutually agreed.
We mutually agreed with fire a couple maybe even last year, about selection processes for engineers. And so we mutually agreed to discuss that because there were things on both sides that we wanted to address. And so we opened that up and had a discussion, and we came back with an amendment to the CBA related to that. So that's an example of when both sides had something that they were interested in changing.
Typically,
in that particular section.
Typically, it's something that's unknown at the time that you enter into the contract. Otherwise, it gets designated in the contract, the parameters of what you're going to keep talking about in the following year.
Okay, follow up, and then I obviously want to get to the presentations by our employees. To the point when you mentioned they might not have finished by the end, and so we agree to have them in an open item. Do we assign them a timeline of which they have to be agreed upon?
So sometimes we do. I'll give you a perfect example, compression pay. We had a specific time frame that we said we would have a proposal to Local 955. Sometimes it's just open, which means our next bargaining session, it will be a topic of conversation. So it can be either way. It can just be listed, meaning we're going to talk about it during the next session, or it has a specific timeline in there. It's what the two groups agree to. And we would put that in writing in the collective bargaining agreement.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it did. I appreciate that.
Okay.
All right. So I guess I'm going to call up first Zach Privet from Local 1055.
There you go.
Does this work? Perfect. All right, for those who don't know me in the room, I'm Zach Privet. I'm the president of the Columbia Professional Firefighters. I represent 160-ish members of our fire department. And we are the one that has a full contract, so there's a lot of work ahead of us. We will review all of our internal department policies. We'll review the contract as it's written that you guys agree to and the city manager signs, and Chapter 19, our ordinances that affect our working conditions. This year, I want to kind of have a theme of a renewed focus on collaboration and our employees. And you'll probably see that as we go through this presentation. All the people in here can make all the decisions you want, but without the people that are on the streets right now in fire trucks, none of that happens. So I want to renew that focus on our employees and make sure that they're forefront in every decision that we make. Just for tonight's presentation, like I said, there's so much to go over. There's some hundreds of policies that we need to look through. Chapter 19 is a pretty broad thing, but some of the priorities we're going to talk about tonight are improvements to this process. You just saw Chapter 19. We've drafted an amendment to Chapter 19. We've borrowed from other municipalities in the state. And so how we can improve the collective bargaining process. Voluntary recognition of some of our support staff. As the fire department's grown, we've also added additional staff. That's going to continue as time goes on, and we'll talk more about that. But those members are directly supporting the operations of the fire department and also deserve to be represented as part of the labor organization. Every year, you're going to hear about compensation. We'll talk about it. Staffing. And then I'm going to talk to you guys about a new retirement health insurance program that I think it's pretty innovative and a way to use current resources without adding additional costs for our members post-retirement. So collective bargaining, obviously there's no state statute that tells us what the guardrails are. That process is left up to us to negotiate. I promise you we're working on that in Jeff City, but nothing is accomplished in Jeff City right now. So, but that's left up to us to negotiate. So our proposal will include enhanced dispute resolution. I know we've talked about it before. You've heard it from all of us before. The term binding arbitration. Calling balls and strikes. Sometimes that we need a third party to get in there. Currently, we use mediation. But at the end of that process, there doesn't have to be a determined outcome. That can just be left open. The mediator is not required to issue an opinion or any binding decision. And so we can prevent litigation using arbitration. And costs go down, all of those things. So we'll talk more about that. Define guardrails, good faith, bad faith. Again, calling those balls and strikes, who's in line and who's out of line. The proposal we'll have better guardrails for that. Some better definitions for the bargaining process. Also, it includes some help for you guys as council members in having somebody to help guide this process for you directly. And then, you know, there's always a mutual benefit to these things. It's not just about the labor saying the city's doing something wrong. I don't believe that there's an ill will or anything from the city, or vice versa. I'd hope that you guys don't believe there's ill will from us trying to advocate for our employees. That's our job. And so there's mutual benefit to these improvements. Like I said before, voluntary recognition of some of our support staff. There's currently 7 employees that we're talking about. These are the job titles that they would be in. They all serve in vital roles supporting our day-to-day operations. They work alongside our traditional operations personnel in the training division. Our administrative assistants to do our payroll, specifically in the fire department. I'm not asking for the rest of the administrative assistants in the city. And our fire department public information specialists and equipment technicians. And they fit perfectly in the support function of the current bargaining unit. And this is not uncommon. In other bargaining units, you might see mechanics. You might see these positions as a part of that fire department bargaining unit because they are supporting the day-to-day operations. So we believe they deserve to have representation too. Compensation. So we can go, this will go on forever, but as I talked about our focus on our employees, we can't lose sight of the economic conditions we live in. 50 to 60% of Americans are currently living paycheck to paycheck. I don't know what those numbers are here in the city, but we have to assume that they're in those numbers somewhere. And so we like our pay scale that we have worked with the city to get to here. But we have to continue to consider the inflation rates, consumer price indexes, and our buying power. What I want to point out is that today our employees take home less money than they did 3 years ago. It costs more to live today than it did 3 years ago. And so while we've made improvements to our wages and salaries, our employees are still behind. And I'll show you a little bit what that looks like in a second. So we're going to talk about some of the proposals we have. We want to add another step to continue to grow our pay plan, continue our step moves, and then our across-the-board adjustments for economic conditions that we see. A little more on the CPI. Over the last 12 months, we've seen that come down from, I think in the peak of 2020, 2021, it was like 9%, down to 2.5%. However, prices haven't come down. And that's where we talk about the inflation rate. The prices have remained high, so our members are paying more for the goods and services that they buy every day. And their paycheck is basically less. They're able to use less of that money for discretionary spending. The average, roughly $1,000 a month, that's $12,000 a year. Again, I'll show you that study in just a second. And our wages just didn't keep pace. We have to continue to make improvements on that so we don't get even further behind. And I put this in here. The median home price in Columbia is $340,000, $350,000 right now. The starting salary for a firefighter is $49,000. I don't know if anybody's went to the bank lately or not and asked for a loan, but you will not buy a house for $350,000 on a $49,000 salary. So what can we ask of our employees that are coming to Columbia to work here when they can't even purchase a house, the home at the median value of homes in Columbia? So that's where we talk about across-the-board adjustments, continuing to move our members up the pay scales. This is that study I was talking about. With our raises over the last year, those also include raises over the past 3 years because I use their pay, where they're at in the pay steps currently. A captain at the top step of our pay scale, this is the highest paid person that we represent, with their raises and their salary, basically they're only covering 17% of those additional costs annually. That's it, 17%. They're losing money. And a new entry-level firefighter, 10%. That's all they're covering of those additional costs that are incurred because of goods and services, the price of the goods that we buy. What we're pointing out here is that we're losing money. It costs more to live, and our employees aren't being able to take home any extra money. They're not getting ahead. So that's that on our current salaries. These are additional pays. Basically, these are things that add into our salaries. Specialty team pay is something we've talked about before, but when our employees do more work or more credentialed, they should be expected to be paid more. I don't think anybody in here would take a job promotion or take on more work without the expectation of being paid more for that. So we talk about our hazmat guys, our technical rescue guys, our water rescue guys, the future looks, it might be aircraft firefighting too at some point in the future. Those things are additional pay that we can that we pay employees for serving on those specialty teams, doing those specialty assignments. Our meal allowance hasn't had an adjustment since 2017-18. I don't have to point out that the economic conditions have changed substantially since 2017 or 18. So we are going to propose an increase to that, and we want to tie that to CPI moving forward in the future so that we don't find ourselves continuing to fall backwards. A simple CPI adjustment to a meal allowance would help keep pace with what we do. And then, of course, uniforms and boots. These are all forms of compensation for the work that we do. Staffing. So I will talk a little bit about where we're at right now and then what we're looking for. With Chief Schaefer arriving in August, we discussed staffing and what we want this to look like in the future. NFPA 10 sets a national standard of a four-person minimum on trucks. Everybody can look at the event out on off Scott Boulevard just the other day where we had a four-person truck able to respond, made a rescue. We had four people on that truck that day. They were able to accomplish tasks that we normally wouldn't with our three-person minimums that we currently run. So when Chief Schaefer got here, we talked about this. We changed our model from floating personnel to assigned personnel, and eight of our 13 companies that are in service right now have a fourth person assigned to them. Now, due to leaves and time off and things like that, that doesn't mean there's four people on eight of those trucks every single day. But when those personnel are available, there are four people assigned to that truck. And we continue to work on with three-man minimums. Our goal will be to get to this four-person minimum, and we want to do that in a process. We don't want to, I don't think I can expect the city to dump $5 million into 50 staff right now to make this a reality. And so we have a proposal, and we want to continue to work towards that goal. We need 15 people right now, today, to assign a fourth person to every company in the city. That means every truck in the city would have a fourth person assigned to it. That doesn't mean they're going to always have four people on them, but as we adjust our minimum staffing daily, we can adjust that to increase so that we have some amount of those companies with a fourth person added to them every day. And we can guarantee some element of four-person staffing. And then as we move on from that, we continue to add additional personnel so that we fill those places where there are vacancies, where there are sick leave, injury leave, all those things with that fourth person. We have enough staff to guarantee a four-person minimum throughout the entire year. That would be the goal to get to. And so our proposal will increase or add those 15 personnel that we're asking for right now over the course of the contract. If we were to do it over 5 years, maybe it's three years, five years, whatever that looks like. To get us to that 15 to that four-person assignments, and then work to increase our minimums. And then this is what I'm talking about, a new program we wanted to introduce this year. In 2011, I think, is when that the retirement went away. We had some sort of a system similar to this. Not exactly the same, but similar. But it's no secret that retiree health care is expensive. And so what we propose doing is creating an HSA-style account and allowing our members to choose to take their sick leave buyback check that they currently would get annually and put that amount of money into this HSA account or take the paycheck. They get the choice. And then they can use that account for post-retirement health insurance costs. We currently are already paying this cost with their sick leave buyback. They would just have the option of whether they want a check for that money or they want to save that money for retirement health care costs. It gives us the option for an additional benefit without additional cost to the city. There will be a management type of cost that will come with that and how we're going to manage those resources. But other than that, this gives our employees another benefit, an added benefit. And as we talk about the retirement systems and the pension systems, these are the things, the innovative type of ways we need to look at employment for our employees to create new ways to recruit them and retain them and give them additional benefits at the end of their career. So this is a pretty simple one, but I'm kind of excited about it because we have a lot of guys that are always speaking down my door about retirement healthcare costs. They're just expensive. So I can try to go through this. Obviously, the financial impacts determine on the outcome of bargaining. So while I say it may be $2 million for compensation over the course of a contract, we negotiate it maybe less and maybe more. Other benefits, again, same thing. Staffing, I just put in the $1.5 million. That's an average or a rough estimate. So pretty simple on that one. And on the final thoughts, I'm going to take an opportunity to talk a little broader about fire department operations. I was just looking before I got here at our operational impact review, which reviews construction projects, major projects in the city. And I don't think I'd be remiss to say that as we watch what's happening in LA, we can see the impacts of underfunding or cutting budgets in public safety. I don't think it's a secret. There's no secret about that. The thing about Columbia is we haven't really cut our budgets ever. We just haven't kept pace with growth. We have multiple hotels that are being built right now, multiple apartment complexes, and there are multiple new subdivisions going in. Where are we going to get those resources for the fire department so that we can, that's human resources, as in humans, equipment, stations, maintenance, all of these things have been underfunded for so long. And so I use the term, show me your budget and I'll show you your priorities. It's a pretty simple term. Look what happened in LA. We can look at their budget. When you cut $17 million from your fire department, you're going to have fires that burn out of control. And 12,000 homes are lost. We probably won't see things like that on our that scale here. However, in 2023, we did see a few of the wildland urban interface fires break out, and multiple of our firefighters were sent to the hospital battling those because we weren't resourced for that capacity. As we look into the future, we're going to have to look at substantial increases to these resources for infrastructure, for the fire department, for every department in the city, because we're growing, and we got to keep pace with it. We just simply haven't at this point. Three-person trucks are not normal, not safe. Fire stations in or out of place, we need more of them. Equipment, all of these things are important to how we're able to serve the public and public safety process. So, again, I want to find a way to work together for everybody, so I'm happy to take questions. I don't really need to get in the process. They did a good job, but
okay. We'll take a few and then move on. I know, because
you were talking about your specialty pays, is that, are we currently paying that, or that's something that you would like?
Yeah, okay. We are not. We do have an ad pay for paramedics, but that's the only one we currently have. Yep, and so we just equalize that for the other specialty assignments that we have.
Okay. Thanks.
Other questions for Zach? Yeah, Nick.
I can't remember which slide this is on.
Go ahead.
Please number your slides, Zach.
You're welcome.
It's second or third slide, I think. I'm not sure. Right there.
Sure.
Define guardrails, good faith, bad faith. Can you talk about that some more?
Yeah, it's the calling balls and strikes. Like, what is good faith and what isn't bad faith? Just don't take this the wrong way, Carlin. I don't want to throw any strikes at you by any means. But, you know, both parties are going to walk the lines of what is appropriate for collective bargaining. We're all going to step as far as we can in that line. And sometimes you need a third party to determine what that line is. And I don't believe, and I think anybody who's been in the labor world very often would believe that the guy who signs the contract gets to be the person who calls the balls and strikes. Or unless you want to turn that over to me, and I'll be happy to call balls and strikes for you. So what I'm getting at here is, where are those lines defined, and what processes do we have to when somebody crosses them?
And are you talking about that being a part of the conversation?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely. And binding arbitration would help substantially with that.
Okay. Zach, yes. I think besides metaphors, an example is an example of what might be in those guardrails, like a timing, like a timeline. Sure. Or the definitions that you refer to as far as, like, this is negotiable, this is not.
Correct. Yeah, all of those things are included into those collective bargaining processes. And I actually serve on a committee now that's working on the statewide legislation. So I've spent a lot of time reading where these things are. I mean, in private sector, you have the National Labor Relations Act and the National Labor Relations Board that is that board that does that. They call the balls and strikes, and they set out what those good faith, bad things are. In the public sector, we don't have that, and especially in Missouri, we just don't have that framework.
Betsy's got a question, and then I'll probably move on, and if we have other questions, we'll
obviously ask. Well, I just have a, maybe not quite a straightforward question. The meal allowance that you say hasn't gone up from 2017 to 2018, is that per person? I mean, I generally
it
see
it is per
your
shift
guys.
You work, per person, per shift you work. So right now it's $14 per person, per shift that you work on every day. It's paid 6 months in two separate installments. One in October, and then one for the shifts that you would have, or that you did work in April. It's kind of a convoluted system, but that's per day. It's in ordinance.
Okay. And then that just goes into a kitty because I see your guys out cooking.
We get that paycheck, and we pay our own deal at the grocery store. When we go to the grocery store, we swipe our credit card. So that goes to us in a form of paycheck.
I just didn't know how that was sorted out.
It comes to us in the form of a paycheck, and we pay for our own stuff at the grocery store.
Thanks.
I don't have a specific question. Are you able to make these slides available for us?
Staff will share them with you.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you, Zach. Appreciate it.
No problem.
All right, up next, I have 955, Andrew Hutchinson.
Got it. I was just going to. I don't want to do that.
You got it. Let me get you up here, Andrew.
My name is Andrew Hutchinson, union representative for Local 955, newcomers. As you can see, we have a lot of stuff that we cover. So we represent about roughly 300 folks in our bargaining unit. As clarified earlier, we are not doing a contract this year, so this will be a pretty short presentation. So these are our bargaining objectives. You can see that most of them focus on economic issues, since this is the wage opener. So we're going to talk about some missed market adjustments, we're going to talk about the step scale, and then some ordinance revisions that we're going to be submitting as well. So for pay grade and market adjustments, we tried to discuss this last year in the wage opener. The city's position was that pay grade adjustments and wages were in fact management rights, so we were not able to get real pay grade adjustments dealt with during the wage opener. So we want to make sure that we actually discuss this year. We want to be clear that if the city holds the position that compensation is a management right, and I have papers you can pass around. Although the National Labor Rights Act does not cover public sector labor law in the state of Missouri, the Board of Mediation and other Supreme Court cases have used the framework of what is good faith bargaining as defined by the NLRA, the National Labor Rights Act. And if we continue to see that compensation held as a management right in the wage opener, we're going to resort to other activities. It's not helpful to go through the full list of pay grade adjustments, but with the things that Mr. Prevett had discussed earlier, as well as some positions that we believe were missed in the class and comp study, and with the increase of the minimum wage coming, we're seeing compression at the low and high ends. And these are some of the job titles that we really want to look at so that folks can keep up with the cost of living to live and work in Mid-Missouri. Met a lot of folks. The City of Columbia has a great retirement system. We have heard folks who would like to discuss, our members to be clear, the increase of the 401A matching contribution. So our step scale is a little bit strange. I don't know if council's aware of this, but the maximum of our step scale does not actually go to the maximum of the pay range. So we have folks who are maxed out on the step scale and unable to get to the full max of that pay grade, of that pay range. So what we want is to add some additional steps so that folks can actually max out in their grade. The city, originally when we were talking about this, the idea was that we were going to leave space at the end for merit raises, but since the scale has been in place for these years, we haven't seen any merit raises, so we want to make sure that folks aren't getting hamstrung with their raises just by the nature of being in a step scale. These are some of our ordinance adjustments. We hear a lot of complaints when you have to do a DOT physical, which is usually right when you're starting in your position. A lot of times, the occupational medicine doctor refers folks to sleep studies. Yes, these are covered by insurance, but individuals have not hit their deductible yet, and it's something that they have to do in order to maintain their job. So we want to talk about, similar to how when we've sent folks to get drug tested to maintain their job, that the city looks at what can we do to help with these sleep studies so that folks are not being priced out of employment. Additionally, on holidays, we have folks who are mandated to work 10 or longer hour shifts. Now, when you receive a holiday, you actually just get 8 hours of holiday pay. So what you see is that folks actually have to use their accrued leave in order to get the holiday off. And that's been an issue that has come up a bunch of times. An increase to the standby pay, and then similar to what Mr. Brevetta discussed earlier, but rather than just negotiations, we actually see binding arbitration for contract violations. So if we say that someone missed out on a chance for overtime in public works because the seniority system was messed up, we want to actually be able to get to a place where a third party comes in and says, the city messed up, this person should get the money that they're owed. Because what we've seen is, with it ending at the city manager level, is that there are times where the city will admit that there was a failure in the process, but not actually deliver the monetary damages that that worker was owed. And we want to make sure that we have binding arbitration to keep both sides equal on this playing field. And that's really it.
Questions for Andrew? Yeah, Betsy and then Nick.
You talked about how, since we have the step scale that has not been keeping up, it's how long have we had a step scale?
I think about 3 years now. Is that correct? When did we, was that in the last contract? So that was
4 years?
I think we bargained it in 22 and it took effect in 23.
Was it in the last one or the one we're currently under? Or
It's the one we're currently under, okay. But it's a...
That would have been in 22.
For FY24,
yes.
And then
we did it.
For FY25, we said we'd work on compression, and this year we're working on trying to get a new performance management system so that phase three of the class and comp set needs to work on performance pay. So we're in phase three, which aligns with the timing of the contract. So we've had a step plan for FY24 in the current year. So
2 years, one and a half, not even half.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Nick.
Please number your slides.
Andy. is...
Can you go to the previous one? Can you just talk a little bit more about this, about addressing arbitration within the amendment,
right,
versus the ordinance? And can you just speak again to what you're looking for?
Yeah, of course. So right now, if you do a CBA complaint or a grievance, or a disciplinary review, which in normal labor world we just call all those a grievance, it ends with the city manager as the final step. So in every other process, even the city of Centralia, almost every other contract I have, whether it's municipality, county, whatever, it ends with binding arbitration. So what that means is when you get to the end of that process, if I believe that we are right and the city believes that they are right, then we can both split the cost of an arbitrator to then award that decision. Does that make sense?
I think so.
Yeah. Right now, the complaints just end.
But
at the city manager.
But you're talking about here about a CBA amendment rather than an ordinance change. So this is contained within an ordinance.
Well, right now, the entire grievance process is within
the CBA.
No, it's within Chapter 19.
Yes, sir.
I don't think we've necessarily mined an MOU that goes into the CBA, but generally it's all been handled in Chapter 19.
I can clarify on this one where I think this part, the bottom one is going, Andrew, is it because in part of the conversation that we've seen in other cities where binding arbitration has been decided in the favor of the union, unfortunately, there was no more budget?
Yeah.
And so you're trying to find that.
So I think they're similar but different in that some folks talk about, well, it's two different processes. Binding arbitration for negotiations is one thing. For what we're talking about here with for contract violations, I'll give you an example. If the city fires someone and we believe that they did not have just cause, right now, we can take that all the way, but it ends with the city having the final say. Binding arbitration means a third party would weigh in on, did they have just cause to fire this employee or did they not? So it doesn't have as much to do about competing budgets or economic fallout.
Valerie, did you have a question? five.
Just so I'm clear, if you go, if you were to go to binding arbitration, you and the city split the bill. Who are the parties who split the cost of arbitration?
The city and the union.
And the union. Okay.
Yeah. And they're not cheap.
Yeah.
So it's not something you would do all the time.
And it's not on the employee.
And often what ends up happening is because it, in my experience in the private sector and in the public sector where we've had binding arbitration, it convinces both sides to negotiate and come to a conclusion that satisfies both rather than going to the arbitration board, because you know you have that can be a weighty cost and you're actually having to evaluate your case. Well, do I really think I have a grievance here? Do I really think I have a discipline case here?
Yeah, risks and financial incentive.
Mm. Other questions for Andrew? I have, one's related to this conversation. On the previous presentation, we saw the potential of arbitration after mediation. Is it your thought as well, is that mediation would be part of the first before going to binding arbitration because you're taking into account that cost of actually going through?
I'll say that isn't something that we discuss at our union meetings, but I don't think it's something that we wouldn't welcome.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, and then the second one is related to the holidays. Talk more about the, if people are working like 4/10s and a holiday, the example of Monday, let's say does that mean that they have to take 2 hours of time off, or I'm trying to, they would take personal time. Does that mean they're supposed to come in for those remaining 2 hours?
So I've asked this question to the membership if they could come in those remaining 2 hours, and to be honest, I haven't had anyone say they would even want to try. But I would defer to the city, you know, for the folks on 4/10s in the street department, if a holiday falls on it, do they have the option of coming in those 2 hours?
With the supervisor's approval, they can flex those hours, meaning work extra that week as long as it's within the same FLSA cycle, which starts at 7 a.m. on Sunday, ends at 6:59 a.m. On Sunday. They can make up those hours. And I believe, Shane, are you in here somewhere? Fleet operations. I know that they allow their employees to, you know, move to 5/8 that week or work extra hours. So it's between the employee and the supervisor.
It's a little easier in fleet. As long as you've got multiple folks there, they can work on something.
Right.
In streets where you're working in a crew environment, that'd be a little bit more difficult because you need at least an entire crew there and something to work on. So it's a little bit, it's not quite as practical.
You couldn't have just one guy on a crew come in and say, I'm going to work those 2 hours on MLK Day.
Right.
And just for everyone's information, employees that are regularly scheduled 2,080 hours per year, which is a standard 40-hour work, and we're not talking about overtime, just regular scheduled, they get 10 designated holidays at 8 hours each, which are 80 hours. Firefighters that work a 29-12, they have some old holidays where they get 24, but new ones are 11.25 hours, and the conversion for that is that 29-12 is 1.4 times more hours than 2080, and 1.4 times 8 equals 11.2, and we only do a quarter, so that's 11.25. So everybody's getting the same hours of holidays based on their annual work schedule. And that is very convoluted that that's...
Mm-hmm. I actually followed it.
Did you follow? But did I do the math?
I wasn't following the calculator, but yeah. I followed
the concept.
What the intent
logic.
Is behind it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The intent of the ordinance is written that it intends to give everyone at least one day off work. So.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a little bit of mix up there.
Okay. So I think for some of these, like, clarifying their stuff. Okay. Other questions for Andrew? No, thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Andrew, I can't remember just where you said you were talking about this, but you mentioned, I think, things missed in the class and comp study.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about that?
These were not, there was a number of titles that were not evaluated on the class and comp.
Okay.
Those titles just weren't evaluated. Like, I'll give you, these are some of them. Another one that we were able to get addressed last year was equipment mechanic over at Parks and Rec.
There's one guy who does that job. And his position was not evaluated. He does really similar work to vehicle mechanics, and he was making considerably less, and we got that pay grade adjusted. But container maintenance techs who regularly fill in for refuse collector twos, those are the senior position on the solid waste collection, and they do, in our opinion, like, RC2s can't fill in for container maintenance, but container maintenance, a lot of their job, because we're short, is driving those trucks. They're getting step-up pay when they do it, but this goes back to really the original old model of solid waste was starting as a temp, you're working residential, you're working commercial, you're going to container maintenance. And we've kind of mixed things up a bit, because now these folks are way higher in terms of years of service, and some of them are actually some of our folks who are completely maxed out. So when we get that step increase, all they got was the cost of living adjustment. So, yeah, we believe that a lot of these, and part of that is, I mean, Zach, I think you have 5 job titles. I think I probably have like 4 dozen.
Yeah.
It's a lot. So there's a lot to do. Maybe that's a little high, but it's a lot.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, thank you, Andrew.
No problem.
All right, next up we have CPOA. Oh, Don's, I was like wondering where you were.
Outside.
He was outside. Oh, well, presentation, Don.
How are you? Get you going.
Thank you. Good evening. I'll try to make it brief. Don Weaver on behalf of CPOA. We have the same goal we've had for several years, and the same goal that I believe the chief has, the same goal I believe the council and staff has. And ultimately, that goal is to be able to attract and retain the best and the brightest to serve as Columbia police officers. And thus far, from the data, it's a resounding failure on our collectively on our part to be able to do that. You know, right now, depending on where you count, we have somewhere between 20 and 54 vacant police officer positions. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that we have to do whatever it takes to be able to fill those spots with competent, qualified, dedicated public service. And so we have a couple ideas, and we're just going to touch on the highlights of what we hope to discuss with city staff during collective bargaining. And one big thing that we believe is essential to make sure that we can attract and retain the best and the brightest to be Columbia police officers is pay. And not just starting pay, and not just some levels of pay, but a comprehensive pay plan that includes predictable and automatic pay increases with successful service through the entirety of what we expect folks' career will be. And, you know, we'll refer to that as a pay step plan. And I think various groups have talked about it, and I'm sure you've discussed it before, but, you know, we want to be competitive. We want to be, I'd say, more than competitive if we want, you know, the best and the brightest. One of the open items in our contract is our discussion about the police pension. And the data doesn't lie in that pre-2012, or I think for at least a couple decades, Columbia Police Department had zero trouble filling vacancies because we had really a best-in-class pension offering to attract the best and the brightest to be Columbia police officers, and then to make sure they served the entirety of their, you know, we'll say productive law enforcement life. That pension took care of that. That doesn't lie on that, and so, you know, we'd like to enhance, potentially restore the pension that was pre-2012. The third item I want to talk to you guys about briefly is not an open item. And I know you've discussed it briefly in the introductory remarks. We're going to again ask the city to open discussions about this issue. And I know you guys were asking for examples of times when both parties agreed. I can't think of any. I know we've asked. but we've always been told no. So I would hope and encourage council to direct staff to have a discussion with us on this issue this year. And really what we're asking for here, it's I know the last two presenters have described it to you in slightly different ways, and there's binding arbitration. And in my mind, the way I think of it is there's kind of two categories of things that might end up with binding arbitration. One involves contract disputes. In other words, if there's an impasse at the end of the collective bargaining process, you know, a common way and a great way to settle those disputes is taking that to binding arbitration. You know, CPOA is supportive of that, but this is not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about here is binding arbitration for disciplinary appeals. And I know other labor groups have talked about this, you know, but the fact of the matter is that Columbia police officers are afraid to do their job because they know that at the end of the day, there's a single person making a determination about whether their actions were right or wrong. And don't get me wrong, CPOA does not want a bunch of cheerleaders, you know, in any capacity. What CPOA wants and what its members want is to be held accountable. And it's not every day you find a group coming up here and say, please hold us accountable. There's a slight asterisk to there, it's not hard to understand, but we want to be held accountable. Did our actions fall in line with the law and policy and trade? That's what being held accountable means, and we are ready, willing, and able to be held accountable. What we don't want to be held accountable to is some post-incident political whim, and that's the fear. Is that, as you guys know, police officers are often forced to make decisions that can garner some degree of public attention, not always positive. And again, you know, as you guys know, the city manager serves at the pleasure of council, and the chief serves at the pleasure of the city manager. And so the fear, and I'll just tell you, cops are pessimistic, folks. You probably already know that, but you know, they're afraid, hey, I might be judged by something after the fact, some facts I didn't even know. Or I might be kind of thrown under the bus if something looks bad, even if I did everything according to my training and according to policy and according with the law, because, you know, the agenda-driven activists kind of raise a ruckus. And so that's the fear. Those are the three things that I was going to talk to you about. Since I didn't take up 10 minutes, I will kind of take this opportunity to reinforce what I've been trying to talk about for the last couple years. You know, CPOA, you know, we want the city to support law enforcement. That's it. It's essential for community safety. And, well, we do support law enforcement. Look, we voted in a larger budget last year. Or we do support law enforcement. We gave them the equipment they were asking for. From CPOA's perspective, that's not really how you support law enforcement. When we talk about supporting law enforcement, we specifically use the word law enforcement, not police officers, because it's really twofold. We're asking the city leaders to support the function of law enforcement. In other words, encourage the enforcement of the law. Encourage officers to not turn a blind eye to blatant, open, and notorious criminal activity, small or large, in our community. That, we believe, breeds exponential lawlessness. So, encourage policing. Now, that's not just saying you want officers to do it. It means make sure the department's fully staffed so they have the resources to do it. Because when the officers are running call to call, shooting, you know, shooting at McDonald's, et cetera, gang fight in progress, you know, homeless people harassing some motorists, they don't have time to go do proactive policing. And so by your inaction in making sure that the department's fully staffed, you have chosen, intentionally at this point, for this many years, you've chosen to deprioritize actual enforcement of the law. So second thing we mean when we say please support law enforcement is please reserve judgment and please reserve comment on controversial issues until all facts are known. Again, we want to be held accountable, but until the investigation's complete, no one knows all the facts. And we would just ask, you know, for all that is good in the world, just don't judge us or comment about something we're involved in until you know exactly what we're doing. Number three, we had to support law enforcement, which, by the way, is essential to ensure we can attract and retain the best and the brightest. We ask that you do what you can to insulate the line officers from agenda-driven activists. And a big part of that involves allowing them to appeal discipline to a neutral third party who has no skin in the game, who has, you know, no political stake in the community, but who's just going to fairly look at the law, look at the policy, look at the facts, fairly apply that and render a decision that is binding arbitration I talked about. And ultimately, number four, to support law enforcement, we have to ensure that we can attract and retain, and a big part of that is compensation. So pay, benefits, retirement. And that is the end of my presentation. Anybody have any questions?
Questions for Don. Yeah, Betsy.
I have a question about the pension.
Yes.
I understand in 2012 it was changed. I also know that we're not funding the pension plan adequately at this point, and that's certainly a concern for the city council, even if you guys don't think it is. There's been some discussion about trying to get your officers over to loggers, which is the state pension plan, which I understand is comparable to what we have, but is certainly better funded and is professionally managed. And can you speak to the concerns that your group would have about going to that?
I'm not fully prepared to talk about the details of that. We began a discussion with the city, I guess, a year and a half ago, but that discussion was kind of abandoned. We had asked for details and questions. There's a lot of unanswered questions thus far. I'd say in general, we don't believe that is enhancing or restoring the pension benefits. We don't believe that will help attract and retain folks. I understand a lot of reasons why.
Restoring the pension won't attract more
people? Transferring the loggers is not restoring the pension.
Okay.
So the 2012 and prior pension had a much better benefit and is much less comparable to the loggers plan you're discussing.
Okay. But so, our current pension plan is comparable to loggers?
Not quite. It's different and worse in several ways, including the minimum retirement age. Right now, our second-tier police pension doesn't have a minimum retirement age. It just has a minimum years of service. After 25 years, you can begin to draw it. That's different. There's several other differences, and honestly, the city thus far hasn't presented us with the details of what plan are we talking about in loggers.
Okay.
And what would be the plan, if any, to transition existing folks to it, let them buy in? You know, there's all kinds of unanswered questions.
Okay.
And ultimately, that would end up with a third tier, kind of a third class of citizens that we would have currently working in the police department.
Do you have a sense that your officers would prefer more pay or a better pension plan? I mean, if you have to pick one, obviously it'd be nice to have
that's
both.
That's tough. I mean, that's a tough one. You know,
with our younger officers, are they more interested in getting more pay as opposed to worrying about their pension in 25 years? Or
I think, I haven't polled them all recently, but I think just in general, people under 35 don't think much about the pension as much as, you know, older people. So I think as far as attracting new folks, I mean, this is just me speaking, my gut feeling, I think probably pay. Is what attracts them, but the 20-year pension definitely kept them, you know, without argument.
Because that was another comment I'd heard, that if our police officers were on loggers, that would allow them to leave our police department and take their pension with them, but it would also allow us to get police officers from other jurisdictions if, for whatever reason, they were moving into the area.
Yeah, and that's true. It would cut both directions. I mean, I can, and you know, I'm not speaking on behalf of the membership. I don't know the answer to what they would prefer, but yeah, I can see that being a benefit, being able to attract laterals. But then basically, people who kind of get fed up here, they have no reason to stick around. They can just go somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure that's, now, what we have now is a City of Columbia police pension. It's not transferable, and so you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, people are kind of strong-armed into staying, you know, because they have too much to lose. by leaving. Yeah. You know, that's not optimal either. You know, we wish it was a place that everybody just loved and had no complaints about. But
we would like that too.
Yeah. Any other questions?
I just have a clarifying one on your previous slide. I feel like sometimes with number two we have this double-edged sword, because I'll get asked, why didn't you have a press conference for that incident like your predecessor did? And a lot of times those would happen before all the facts were in. So I guess I'm wondering, like, you know, at what level, because obviously people expect us to put out press releases, and, you know, every once in a while they expect from counsel to say, you know, we trust the process, we'll follow through. Like, what, you know what I mean? Are there guidelines that CPOA's put together on?
And I will say this talking point predates any public comment that might have been relevant or in the past. So just so you know, nothing personal. But I mean, anybody, not just police officers, they want to feel supported in their job.
Right.
Okay. And that doesn't mean they can do no wrong, for sure. Right. And that's anybody, including police officers. But when you hear, I'll just say anecdotally, when you hear no public comment in support of police action or law enforcement action in general, except maybe when there's a, you know, some kind of community event or some kind of, you know, help the stranded motorist, which is really not, I mean, it is within the scope, but it's not the actual enforcement of laws. And then the only public comment you hear is when officers take action in the course of their job that, you know, kind of looks ugly. It creates an impression, at least, among officers that, like, gosh, how come, you know, I never heard anything positive when I did this, but all of a sudden, you know, here's what we hear when there's this public outcry. So we would love to work with the city to develop some guidelines, but, you know, the answer is, in my mind, put out what you can. That would be in the way of actual body cam footage or actual evidence, and say, here's what we know now. We're not making any conclusions. We're not forming any opinions till the investigation's done. Here's everything we have. You know, that's my personal opinion. And that can be done even on non-controversial incidents.
Yeah, I think part of it is also in our form of government. I don't know that council members would necessarily get this good thing happened, right? Like, right? But I think that's every job. I think that's every department. Yeah. You don't always hear the good things. I don't often get the emails telling me thank you.
No, I understand.
All right, well, thank you, Don. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
All right, moving on. So we'll go to legislative priorities first. And then closed session after that, if we have time? Okay. All right, so moving on, we're going to our legislative priorities discussion. As a reminder, this was kind of a carryover from the last meeting because due to the weather, we did not have any people here.
You didn't have a treehouse.
Wasn't
able
to get back home.
Yeah.
Oh.
So I think we're kicking this to Stacey Wiedemann. Is that correct, Stacey?
Yep.
Okay.
Do we have a revised timeline of how long we're up here?
How much time were you given?
Are we still half-hour-ish, or do we need to cut it down?
No. You're fine.
Okay.
You're fine.
I just didn't want to be up here talking.
You're good. I forgot about that.
So first we'll do, I guess I just told you to sit down, we're going to introduce ourselves, so come on.
Yeah. Okay, we'll stand back up.
Sorry.
Do you want me to go ahead and
introduce?
And the acoustics in this room are not good, so make sure to project.
I do not have a voice that carries very well, so I apologize. I'm Susan Henderson Moore, and I'm the managing partner of our Polsinelli office in Jefferson City. We're a law firm that's headquartered in Kansas City, but we have a small office in Jeff City that focuses on government affairs. And we represent the city of Columbia down in Jefferson City. So we are your boots on the ground for the day-to-day activity going on in the Capitol. I am a Columbia native, so this is one of my areas that I enjoy, and getting to represent our community and our town. And like I always tell people, I'm a townie, born and raised. So.
My name is Kara Alexander Stark, and I am the legislative director with Polsinelli. And while I don't live in Columbia now, I graduated from Mizzou and lived up here for many years, so big fan.
We all have our credentials. I'm Stacey Weideman. I'm the Constituent Services and Legislative Affairs Administrator in the City Manager's Office. So we prepared a really brief presentation. I think what we're more interested in is hearing from you all, hearing what your priorities are for this legislative session. But we do want to kind of just do kind of a brief refresher on the state legislative process. I'll tell you a little bit about the reporting that you'll see throughout the session, talk a little bit about fiscal notes, and then issues to watch and what our priorities are, our start of what some of our areas of interest are, rather. So in Boone County, we have one state senator, and the county is divided up into five House districts. So you can see I've got our representatives listed there. Senator Weber, as well as Representative Martin and Representative Bush, were newly elected in. This is their first term. I know Senator Weber served in the House, I believe, but his first time in the Senate. Those are who we have representing us in Jeff City. Just briefly about the legislative process. As you know, I'm sure you all know this, this is just a refresher. Bills originate in both House, both the House and the Senate, but ultimately they have to go through each. So this makes for a really long process for a bill to finally make it to the governor's desk. So here's kind of a flow chart that kind of shows you a bit through it, starting with filing and working its way all the way down to like being assigned to a committee and having a floor debate and everything. And then eventually it will go to the other chamber. So it is a very, very long process. It was designed to be a long process. I wanted to kind of show you this chart just so you can also see some of the wording, because that'll show up on the reports that I share with you. So throughout session, I'll be sending emails with bills of interest, and I do the same thing with the departments as well. The bills that show up on the list for City Council are really made up of bills that I've heard from staff that are of high priority. So high priority bills for finance or fire, whichever department is gonna show up on your list. Bills that you've told me collectively that you're very interested in, topics the council's interested in. I wanna include those on your list so you can track them easily. As well as kind of just big community things. Like last year, you'll remember that there were bills related to charter schools in Boone County. Those don't really fit into a department list, but those are definitely something that you'll kind of want to keep track of or be aware of. So you'll see some of those again this year as well. Like I said, I do the same report for departments. They're all kind of curated lists. So you'll get an email from me with just information about the bills that are making progress, as well as a link to a report. And here's, it's not very easy to read up here, but I'll be emailing this to you all later this week. This is just a snip of it, but it's a full report with bills that I think you might want to be keeping your eye on. So the things that you'll see on this list, you'll see the bill number, you'll see the sponsor and the name of the bill, and that's hyperlinked, so it'll take you to the state or Senate site, so you can read the full bill text. You can see any sort of fiscal notes or anything associated with it. It also provides a brief summary, and it'll show the last action, which is where it's kind of handy to go back through and see all these different stages, because you'll see, you know, when things have been heard, if things have been assigned to a committee, it'll kind of show you the steps there. So as I mentioned, if you are interested in a particular bill and you go to the state website, you can see if any fiscal notes have been submitted for it. We do submit fiscal notes. I work very closely with our finance department, particularly the economics division, to monitor bills and determine which ones would be beneficial to submit a fiscal note on. We also get information from the Missouri Municipal League on what bills they're encouraging their members to look at closely. So, for example, any sort of bill related to sales tax exemptions. So last year, there were a number of bills related to exempting from food sales from sales tax. That's a pretty significant percentage of our sales tax revenue. I think last year it was about 15%. We're going to be reviewing that this year and getting some estimates submitted again. If there is a bill that involves more than just finance, if it involves another department, we work with that department as well to see what the impact may be. Because what a fiscal note is, it really is just an estimate of what the financial impact of a proposed bill would be. So I know that was pretty fast. Any questions about the process or any of the reporting that you'll see? All right, perfect.
So before we get into the substance of it, I'll kind of round out what Stacy said of what we do and then what you guys end up seeing. So Kara and I, our job, there are thousands of bills filed every year, right? And so we are looking at it from the overall view of not only the things that are necessarily directly relating to Columbia, but also things that have the potential to grow and become an omnibus bill. So Stacy has bills on her list that she probably sees like, we don't really care about that. But it's the potential of what could happen, because we always say the way that our legislature operates, it's kind of the Wild West of amending. We don't have a lot of rules of like, it's got to get out of this committee by this time or switch chambers by this time. It's all alive until the last day. And so because there is so much going on and it's such a condensed time frame, you just really can't keep track of it unless you're down there every day. And then our decision too is when we have issues of interest, you know, that Stacy and DeCarlin and folks have brought to our attention, is that something that we want to officially go on the record about? Is that something that we want to talk to individual legislators about? Is that a more productive route? We talk a lot with the Municipal League, other similarly sized cities, and kind of coordinate our efforts that way. So there's different pieces of it, and it's not always the things that you see in the paper or, you know, the things that you see in the news. There's a lot going on that doesn't get a headline. So just to kind of, do you have anything that I missed there?
No,
I think so that being said, where we're at right now, they just started session on the 8th, and it was a new legislature, which means they have new leadership, they're reforming the committees, new committee chairs. And so it's, those are always the years it's off to a slow start because they have to like pass their rules and do all the procedural things. So we're just now getting started this week on committee action. And so it's always one of those years of like slow start, which means that at about spring break, we'll pick off and things will be flying. That being said, they only passed 28 substantive bills last year. If you saw in the news, there was a lot of disagreement, actually, amongst, well, it was intra-party disagreements. And so not a lot passed besides the budget. So there's a lot, we've talked about, there's a lot of what we would call like a retread, a redo of issues that come up, many of them in the local government space. So there's that. So one thing, though, that is of interest, just because of our dynamics between the legislature and different communities and different interests in the state, is, as you know, we have a very active initiative petition process where, obviously, if you know people are of more liberal leanings, they are not getting necessarily the results that they hope to see out of a majority Republican-controlled legislature. So we had a lot on the ballot this year, and it's just an interesting dynamic to watch and to be aware of, because I think a lot of people focus on that legislative aspect, but the initiative petition process, you know, they're already starting to file for the next go-round for the next general election, and that's the same thing. Hundreds of those get filed. What actually ends up on the ballot is a much smaller number, obviously, because they have to get all the signatures. But obviously, people are most familiar with the access to abortion and sports wagering, which, you know, got a lot of press. And also the...
it's on the next page, right?
Is it on the next page? Okay. Oh, yes, test story. And then the minimum wage, which I know was referenced in one of the other earlier presentations. And so that's an interesting one in the fact that probably if there hadn't been some of these other really high-profile issues on the ballot, we might have heard more about it, but I feel like most people will, there wasn't as much discussion as one would have maybe expected in a different year. So just putting that out there of these are the things that we pay attention to as well. Every 2 weeks, we go through and see what initiative petitions have been filed. So. Yeah, you can keep going. All right. You want to talk about it? You want to start?
Sure,
and I'll
yeah.
finish her off? Okay.
So these are some of the general
issues that we expect to see pop up this year that might be of interest to you guys. All of the stadiums are coming out and saying they'd like money. We expect them, the Columbia community to be a part of that. So we are looking at sports stadium funding and the budget in general. It's going to be kind of an interesting year for the budget because the last couple of years we've had this big abundance of federal money, and every year it's gotten a little bit smaller and there's been a little less to give out. And this is really the first year where I think we're going to see a lot of conservative behavior around the budget, if you want to.
Yeah. Well, in the sports stadium funding, the impetus obviously comes from everybody knows that Kansas made the Chiefs a huge offer, right? And so there is the expectation of, well, what is Missouri going to bring to the table to keep them? And so there's that in and of itself, but anytime, you know, you have one large entity, then it's, you know, the Cardinals or whoever, you know, like everybody is like, well, what about us? And so it kind of turns into this more global conversation. So there's obviously, you know, when the Chiefs are involved, it's high profile, you know, it's interesting to people, it's in the news. So that is something that is there. But like Kara said, our budget, they have this number called the consensus revenue estimate. I'm sure you guys have your version of it here with the city, with the projected revenues for the state. And where the state has been at, it's been like 3 or 4% the last few years. It's like under 2% this year. And then they readjusted last year's down into the negative. So essentially, we're kind of projected to be, as a state, running even. Mm-hmm. Do you have a comment?
Yeah, Doug.
When you say 3 to 4%, 2% negative,
percent of what?
The projected revenue growth.
Growth, there we go. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah.
Last word.
You know how it is when you get into acronyms and you talk your own language. So that's where we're at of, like, and there are two major issues that they anticipate, you know, costing potentially a lot of money. Obviously, the stadium, the Chiefs issue. And then last year when they did pass that big education bill that had the charter provision in it, in order to get that passed, it required a lot of negotiation. And so there were a lot of pieces put in to get people on board with it. And, you know, various of those pieces have fiscal notes. So the projection is that that bill has a fiscal note of, I mean, several hundred million dollars. Several hundred million, yeah. And so how much is that really going to cost? Because that's, you know, there's only so much of the state budget that is not federal flow-through money, general revenue. So those are kind of the big question marks. That and the lack of federal funding now that we have been used to in recent years has come to a close.
I'll do a portion and you want to do anything?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So then the next thing we expect to come up this year, I know we just talked a little bit about initiative petition reform. You know, obviously the abortion amendment passed. We expect our legislature to go right back and change that. And we expect that issue to take up a lot of oxygen in the room. So we always talk about what issues every legislative session are taking up the most oxygen, meaning that they're getting all the headlines, that they're taking up the floor debate, that everything else seems to get tangled up in whether or not these things are moving. We expect that this will be a very large substantive issue this year that ends up taking a lot of energy and maybe detracts from some of the smaller ones. So we've already seen several efforts filed, I mean over probably 20 bills or resolutions that impact this issue directly. They're all in various forms and people are trying to attack it from multiple angles. So we'll see which ones actually end up being the moving target. What I'll say is that the House of Representatives has established a working group where they have several members of the group that are going to be working on how do we want to attack this from the House side. So they'll likely establish a vehicle that travels on that side. So,
yeah. So energy issues. We actually haven't had a lot of energy legislation move in the last, I don't know, handful of years. That being said, the electric utility company, the regulated electric utility companies have some big things that are on their agenda this year. Obviously, being a municipal, you guys are not under the jurisdiction of the PSC and not, you know, not under the same rules as they are. But anytime that you have these like larger energy bills, things end up being combined into one another. And take, for instance, there's a provision out there, which I think Nancy and I, we've talked about the right-of-ways and the easements and about, yeah, so you guys are all shaking your head. and so those are the kind of things that we have to keep an eye out and make sure that all of a sudden, you know, the Senate committee substitute comes out and things that, you know, were not in the bill are then all of a sudden in the bill. So the things that are really probably the most headline, you know, are kind of these, like, really bigger issues about grid reliability. This is coming up more over in the Evergy area, so Kansas City, because they're having all those big data centers and things like that that are just suck up, you know, they use a ton of energy. So there's a lot on just grid reliability. And then QIP, it's construction work in progress. It's an issue that over the years has circled back around. It would allow for the utilities to incorporate the construction into the rates before it's actually online, the facility. And so there's things like that that are out there. And like I said, from Columbia's perspective, you guys aren't necessarily in the thick of it, but those are big, you know, vehicles that, you know, have the possibility of having smaller municipal issues, renewable issues, things like that, you know, jump on board with it. So that's why we mark a lot of things that Stacy might not necessarily, you know, care about in the beginning. And when we say rehashing of healthcare, I mean, there's, as you can imagine, an enormous amount of healthcare legislation. A lot on, you know, scope of practice. I mean, things that are not necessarily the big glamorous things that you see on TV, but, you know, there's always, the nurse practitioners are always wanting to increase their scope of practice. There's things about workforce development because I think everybody's acknowledging, you know, especially in rural areas, there's, you know, lack of healthcare options. So there's a ton of different things that are out there. And especially in the last few years we had, they haven't necessarily passed. And so that's always a big space. And I could stand up here for hours and tell you everything that's out there. But that's the gist of it, of like there's always omnibus bills, and there's always things in that that do take up a lot of time, and, you know, there's turf wars and things like that. So if you want to do crime and...
Yeah, some of those turf wars happen in crime and public safety. So really the main focus for a lot of these public safety bills are going to be on St. Louis. But in an effort to fix what, you know, are some of the public safety problems that are perceived from the legislator, from the legislator's perspective, in an effort to fix some of those things, sometimes other municipalities get wrapped in. So our goal when looking at these bills that where they're targeting some of those bigger cities is to make sure that, you know, we're being careful to not completely wrap Columbia in bad public safety policy. There's also a lot of conversations at the state level for how to address things like homelessness. I know it's a conversation in your community all the time. So we're on the lookout for what type of what type of laws they're putting into the state level and how they might impact you guys, and, you know, shutting down any of the really bad ideas. So, yeah. We'll see some of those come up, and we'll watch out. That's why some of those things in the public safety bills will mark for you guys, and it's to make sure that it doesn't turn into necessarily an omnibus public safety bill that could impact everyone. So
a few areas of interest that we know about right now. This list is obviously going to grow quite a bit.
We first started this when they started pre-filing, and even since now, I'm like, I can think of like 10 other things.
So. Yeah, now, when I was looking at it this morning, I was like, oh, we could add more to this, but... as you remember last year, there was some change. There was a big public safety omnibus bill, and it included some changes to the CPRB. Representative David Tyson Smith filed a bill that we kind of like reverted back to what it was. So that's something that you'll see on your report whenever I share it out with you. Also, healthcare records is an item of interest to our fire department. I think it really, there's a bill that would protect that personal health identification for individuals who are given services by the fire department, for example.
things that we always have on, that make our antennas go up, anything to do with, you know, annexation, obviously, particularly with ambulance service, and that's been something that's, you know, gone on here. Like we said, the utility and the poles and the replacing the costs. There have been one, actually, tomorrow they're hearing it, that has to do with Section 8 vouchers and a city's, I always have to think about how I, it prohibits the city from requiring a landlord to take the voucher. That's a lot of, that's like triple negative in there, I think. but that's one that, that's actually an example of, it was very much originated because of an action that Kansas City took. And it was actually an introduced version that was the impetus for it, which was scaled back even in Kansas City. But it's those kind of reactions, you know, that you see in the legislature. So those are things that...
this is that source of income?
Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah, and so, but those are the kind of issues that, you know, we, when those things come up, you know, we definitely flag them and engage, so.
But we see, like, MML and the city of Kansas City really taking the lead on that issue, and then we help out on the back end.
We also let the appropriate people know, like, you know, this would also affect, I know everybody's mad at whoever in whatever district, but it also has impacts on communities like Columbia, so.
So now we kind of want to hear, like, what, if there are any issues or any areas that you...
And we really... And just to, like, kind of give the general overview of how we view this, obviously there's, like, a flood of information. We